This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recorded recently with country musician Marty Stewart. Stewart is a songwriter, singer, guitarist, and mandolin player who has earned gold and platinum records and won 5 Grammys. He first went on the road at age 13 as a member of Lester Flatt's band. Later, Stewart joined the backing band for Johnny Cash. Marty Stewart also is a photographer. He has a new book of photos of country music performers and fans, and there's currently an exhibit of Stewart's photography at the Frist Center for the Visual Arts in Nashville. Stewart brought his guitar to the studio and will play some songs for us. But let's start with a track from Stewart's new double album, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. This is When It Comes to Lovin' You.
Every minute we're apart, I keep on needing you. That's just what I do. Can't seem to help myself when it comes to loving you. There's a fire that burns down in my soul. It comes with the feeling that just won't let me go. It started the first time that we kissed and left me with a memory that I just can't resist.
That's from Marty Stewart's new album, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. Marty Stewart, welcome to Fresh Air. What a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's an honor to be on your show, Terry. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So why did you want to combine Saturday night kind of songs with Sunday morning spiritual songs?
Well, I've always said that country music has always shared a very unique relationship with gospel music. The hooting and hollering is, you know, always in abundance, but at some point the hillbilly always on stage says, friends, we'd like to do your gospel song. And whether it's Will the Circle Be Unbroken or I'll Fly Away or something deeper, the country audiences always seem to kind of expect it and understand it. And I've always thought it was a really unique relationship that two genres shared.
Did you hear a lot of the Sunday morning songs that you play at church, or do you know most of those songs from country music?
Well, being from Mississippi, the church house is kind of the common denominator. It was for me growing up. Like so many public performers, that was the first place I was ever invited to sing. Mainly, though, the point-blank answer to your question is when I first put the Fabulous Superlatives together, the way we got to know each other musically and spiritually and, you know, was gospel music. Harry Stinson brought the music of the Swan Silvertones and the Dixie Hummingbirds, and Kenny Vaughan loved Sister Rosetta Thorpe's music. He brought her music. Paul Martin came to us and brought music from Southern gospel world. I brought the music of the Staple Singers, Flatt and Scruggs, the Stanley Brothers, and Bill Monroe. And we'd listen to those songs, and that's how we learned to sing together going up and down the road or in dressing rooms when we first put our band together. So at some point, there was just simply a whole lot of gospel material that we had either learned or written that was about, you know, eye to eye with the country set list. So it's always been a part of what we do as a band.
What songs did you hear when you were actually in church?
The standard fare was Amazing Grace, How Great Thou Art. And I always loved, Southern gospel music and traditional hymn book music, but the black gospel songs that touched me I'm from the other Philadelphia, Mississippi. And if you'll remember, in 1964, there was an awful murder there, the slayings of 3 civil rights workers. So all of a sudden, the social conscience changed down there. And the song that I remember more than any other song during that particular time, the Staple Singers had Uncloudy Day and Will the Circle Be Unbroken. Those two records seemed to always play in that part of the world, and that really opened my eyes to a completely different kind of gospel music, a completely different sound of gospel music.
And you do On Cloudy Day with Mavis Staples on your new album.
Absolutely, playing Pop Staples' guitar. And
which they gave to you after he died.
They gave to me, and it was like being handed a responsibility and Excalibur and an instrument of truth all in one. Pops was one of my dearest friends, and I miss him very much. But that little recording of Uncloudy Day that he and his children made in the basement in Chicago, basement recording, I think it came out on VJ Records, still in my mind stands as one of the greatest songs in the American Gospel Songbook. It's such a precious recording. So Mavis coming by to do that. That was the first song, Terry, that we actually recorded for this project 9 years ago, and we built this entire project off of that one song and that one performance.
So since you've recorded On Cloudy Day on your new album, and since Mavis Staples is singing with you on it, why don't we hear that? So this is Marty Stewart with Mavis Staples from his new album, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning.
Oh, they tell me of a home where no stone clouds rise. Oh, oh, they tell me of an uncloudy day.
Well, 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 Lord.
Yes. They tell me,
Lord, they tell
yes.
me now.
Oh, yes, they tell me.
I got a
yes.
home.
Oh, yes,
got a
they
home
tell me.
Beyond
oh,
the sky.
Yes. Oh, yes, they tell
well,
me.
Well,
oh. Yes. Oh, yes, they tell me.
Lord, they
yes.
tell me now.
Oh, yes, they tell me.
Of a
yes.
home.
Oh, yes, they tell
far,
me.
Far away.
Yes. Oh, yes, they tell
away.
Me.
Yes.
Oh, yes, they tell me.
That's Marty Stewart with Mavis Staples from his new album, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. There's Saturday Night songs and Sunday Morning gospel songs, one album for each kind. It's a double album. So
Pop Staples called me one time and said he was coming to town to record with us, and he said, Marty, I need a Fender 65 with some shake on it and a stretch out car. And I said, sure, Pops, whatever you need. Then I called Mavis when it was all done. I said, Mavis, what did I just agree to? What is a Fender 65 with some shake on it and a stretch-out car? She says, oh, Marty. She said, that is a Fender amplifier with some tremolo on it for Pop's sound, and that stretch-out car is a limousine to bring him from the airport. I said, no problem. He was beautiful.
Marty Stewart, you've brought your guitar. Can I ask you to play for us one of the
sure.
original songs that's on the Saturday Night album from your double
okay.
album, and this one's called Rough Around the Edges. Maybe you could talk a little bit about writing it before you play it.
Well, it's autobiographical. I went on vacation from about 1973 to about 10 years ago. Totally rock and roll lifestyle. And the first line of the song says, I woke up this morning with miles of life behind me. My friends and family worry, 'cause they don't know where to find me. Once again, I beg forgiveness for another lost night in my soul. Something bad got a hold on me, and it just won't let me go. Rough around the edges, it's hard to face myself. The mirror in the morning shows a man who looks like death. Can't seem to find a way to steady up and gain control. Rough around the edges, devil's reaching for my soul. anybody relate?
No, that's a great song. So what got you back from the edge?
Well, my heart finally found a home when I married Connie Smith, and I was tired of feeling bad, and it was time to grow up and get on with life. So that's what happened.
You got into country music at such a young age. You were 13 when you started performing on the road with Lester Flatt?
I was. That's right.
So how did you get to tour with him?
My friend, I'd actually been traveling when I was 12 years old. I went on the road for the first time with a Pentecostal gospel bluegrass group from the South called the Sullivan Family Gospel Singers. They were huge regional stars down in our part of the world. And they played Pentecostal churches. They played camp meeting revivals, bluegrass festivals, and George Wallace campaign rallies. And that's the summer. How's that? And so I went on the road that summer and fell in love with the lifestyle of the road. I got to wear clothes the way I wanted to, could wear my hair goofy, met cool people, could stay up late, talk music 24 hours a day, and I got a little bit of money for it and fell in love with applause, and the spotlight charmed me just right on in. So when that summer was over, it was time to go back to school. The Sullivans dropped me off at the edge of Philadelphia, Mississippi, and I felt like the circus had dropped me off at the edge of town and gone on without me. I mean, it killed me. And I got kicked out of school a few weeks in because I was caught reading a country music song roundup book inside my history book. And the teacher came up behind me and said, if you get your mind off of that garbage and get it onto history, you might make something out of yourself. And smart Alex said, well, I'd rather make history than learn about it. And they expelled me. And I called a friend of mine who worked in Lester Flatt's band, who had offered to have me come to Nashville and just ride the bus with him for a weekend. So Lester gave his permission. My folks gave their permission. And that was Labor Day weekend of 1972. And Lester heard me play it in the back of the bus, put me on stage, and the crowd liked it. I loved it. And he offered me a job at the end of the weekend. So it was kind of like that scene in The Wizard of Oz where life goes from black and white to color all in one sweep, and that's what happened to me.
Let's hear how you sounded when you were 13 and on the road with Lester Flatt. And this is when you were on the Porter Wagoner show, TV show. You're going to be doing a song called When the Bluebird Sings, and Lester Flatt sings first, and you're kind of singing echo on this. And we'll also hear you take a mandolin solo.
Okay.
Okay. This is the 13-year-old Marty Stewart with Lester Flatt on the Porter Wagoner TV show.
Bird singing,
here's a bird singing
in a blue ridge,
in the Blue Ridge Mountains, calling me back to mine.
Oh, I can hear,
oh, I can hear
the birds,
the blue birds calling,
calling me back to my home.
That was the 13-year-old Marty Stewart.
The first time he ever put me on stage at the Grand Ole Opry, you know, I was hoping my folks were listening. I knew they were. He put me on stage to play the mandolin, and I was so little I had to stand on my tiptoes to get it up to the microphone. And at the end of the song, the crowd just kept going and going and going, and I thought I had done something wrong. And I looked at him, and he had this look on his face. He was just pure delight. And I said, what did I do? He said, do it again.
It must have felt great to get so much applause at the age of 13.
It's called an Opry moment when something really happens good at the Grand Ole Opry. And at the end of all that applause, I turned around, and all of a sudden there was Roy Acuff, and there was Bill Monroe, Tex Ritter, and there were all these musicians that had been there for years, and they knew something was going on. And they showed up for it, and it was like looking into the face of the Old Testament of country music. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. But it totally made things happen. It made things different around here for me.
And you played with Lester Flatt until his death, right, in 1979?
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
So we were talking before about how you were on the road by the age of 13 with Lester Flatt and stayed with him in his band until his death in 1979. Not long after that, you played with Johnny Cash for several years in his band. How did you end up moving on to Johnny Cash's band?
I needed a job, and I was down in Nashville at a place called the Old Time Picking Parlor, and there was a wonderful guitar builder named Danny Farrington, who was an up-and-coming luthier at the time. And I noticed that on his workbench, he had a beautiful black guitar with an eagle in it, a gold eagle that he was inlaying. I said, "Who's that guitar for?" He said, "Johnny Cash." I said, "Are you kidding? I want to go with you when you deliver the guitar." And he said, "Okay." So we shook hands on it, and I made him promise me he would keep me in mind. But I kept him in mind. I'd check in on that guitar from time to time. The day came, and I went with Mr. Farrington to Cowboy Jack Clements' recording studio over on Belmont Boulevard in Nashville. And when the door swung open, two of my lifelong friends, what came to be lifelong friends, were standing. John had a guitar singing the Wabash Cannonball, and Cowboy Jack Clement had a martini on his head waltzing to the Wabash Cannonball.
Martini on his
and
head?
So or in his I head? Thought, I yeah, on top of his head, not okay. Spilling a drop. And he later showed me he was an Arthur Murray dance instructor in Memphis in the 50s, so he was still showing everybody how he could do that. So that was my getting on place, and about a month later, I was out on the road with Doc and Merle Watson, just working some jobs. And it was the last show, and I knew when I got home from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, I had no earthly idea what I was going to do with my life. For the first time since I was 12 years old, I was out of a job, and this is about 1979. And so my mom called and said, "Bob Wooten, who was Johnny Cash's guitar player, is looking for you." So I picked up the phone at the hotel in Cedar Rapids and called him. I said, "Hi, Bob." He said, "John wants to know if you'd be interested in working in our band." I said, "I would." I said, "When would I start?" He said, "How about tomorrow?" I said, "That's really good news. Where are you?" And they were in Des Moines, Iowa. It's just a short rental car ride away. So I got to the hotel the next day and sat down in the restaurant, and the maitre d' came and said, "Mr. Cash is on the phone." I said, "All right." And he said, "Do you know my song, son?" I said, "Every one of them. Do you still do them in the same key?" He said, "Probably." And he said, "Do you have anything black to wear?" I said, "Probably." He said, "Well, I'm probably going to take a nap, and I'll probably see you at the show." Click, and that's how I got the job.
So, you know, I hope this isn't too personal. A few years later, you married Johnny Cash's daughter, Cindy, and stayed married for 5 years. Did getting married or getting divorced affect your relationship with Johnny Cash?
No. He called me old number nine.
Wait, what did he call you?
The old number nine, the ninth son-in-law. I wasn't the first guy to come through to marry one of the Pretty Cash girls or the Carter girls that didn't work out. So I think from day one, there was an understanding that he was my chief and my boss and my mentor, but when I became the son-in-law, that was a completely different room. That lived in a different room. But we kept our professional relationship totally separate. And after Cindy and I were divorced, you know, he was mad at me for 5 minutes, and he got over it, and we got together and played the guitar and never said a word about it. And to the day he died, we actually became next-door neighbors. Connie and I lived next door to John and June, so we were friends to the day he died.
Well, just a few days before he died, you took his photo, and that photo is in your book that collects your photos, and it's also at the exhibit of your photos in Nashville now.
At the Frist.
At the Frist. Yeah, it's a beautiful photo.
Thank you.
Do you want to describe it?
Well, it was 4 days before he passed away. I was over at his house, and I have no idea. I probably had a bag slung over my shoulder. I had just been to Folsom, California, and I had been given a gate pass to go to the prison to see where he had made his Folsom Prison album. And at that point, I was just looking at anything to talk to him about, just anything to keep him entertained, because June had recently passed away. And so I went next door to have a cup of coffee and just kind of share with him my impressions of Folsom Prison. The day I went there, the country band, the Folsom Prison country band, was playing, so we played Merle Haggard's song, Folsom Prison Blues, of course, and a song that I wrote called "The Whiskey Ain't Working Anymore." And those guys, we had a ball. But that band hall in its former days was the Hanging Gallows. And it haunted me all the way home. I kept thinking, the job of a hangman, what a rotten job. What do? Go home at night and tell your wife, "I did a great job today." And I had started a song, and I took next door to John. We actually wrote this song called Hangman that we did on a record called Ghost Train. And it was the last song that he ever wrote. We just finished the song together. And he was sitting there in his chair looking so pretty, and the light, after late afternoon light, was coming in from behind. I said, "Jared, let me take your picture." And I knew he didn't want to, but he let me. And there were three frames, and the first two he just kind of looked tired and weary. But on the third frame, I said, J.R. And he sat up straight and pulled on that black collar, and he became Johnny Cash. And I got through, and I started to leave the room. He said, is there anything in this room you want? I said, just your love. He said, well, you got that. I said, well, you have mine too. And I said, I have to go to Washington. Can I bring you anything? He said, I'll bring me the Washington Monument. I'll be home in 3 or 4 days. I said, you okay? He said, I'm okay. I said, how's your spirit? He said, strong. I said, you got plenty of rope left in there? He said, I got plenty of rope. I said, I love you. And so I'll see you when I get home. And so 4 days later, he was gone. I got the word on the way home from that trip.
Hmm. So you went on your own as a solo performer in the 80s. And I'm going to ask you to play an early song of yours that you still like a lot and that helped establish you. And I'll ask you to choose one that you'd like to do.
There was a song that I fell into a writing spell in the beginning with a great songwriter named Paul Kennerly. He had a record called White Mansions that he had done, and The Legend of Jesse James, I think. But he was also writing hit songs for Emmylou Harris and the Judds. And he came from England, so he brought this wonderful rock and roll perspective along with him to the countryside of things. And we were writing songs, and he was a great Buddy Holly fan. And I had just worked on a session with a Roy Orbison as a guitar player. And Paul was inspired by Buddy Holly for some reason at the moment. And we wrote this song called Tempted. If I can put it. There's a girl trying to steal my heart, and I'm tempted. Even though she could tear it apart, I'm tempted. In her eyes there's mystery. Every time she smiles at me, well, I know how it could be, and I'm tempted. Tempted and tried, deep down inside, I can't deny that I'm tempted. And I heard it the first time on the radio when I went to Lubbock, Texas.
I love that
Texas.
Song, by the way. Yeah.
Thank you. I heard it the first time on the radio when I was in Lubbock, Texas, which was Buddy Holly's hometown. And I'd gone to the local station to do a radio interview to promote the show that evening. And I said, would you do me a favor? And I handed him a test pressing of the song Tempted. And the record company didn't think it was a single. I said, would you play this for me so I could hear it in the car on the way back to the hotel? And he did, and when he got through, he said, I believe that's a hit song, and I think Buddy Holly would be proud to endorse that song himself. And I thought, that is the first time I felt like I had found my own sound, and we had found kind of the mark I was looking for, and it was a real getting on place for me. So I still am very fond of that song Tempted.
You've embraced a lot of aspects of country music from the 60s and 70s when you were coming of age, including the kind of rhinestone embroidered suits. And I think there's an aspect of country music that a lot of people were rejecting at that time because they considered it too commercial, too show busy, including the suits. So talk about why you not only embraced it, you collect it. You have this huge collection of like nudie suits and also of great country music performers, guitars, and other instruments. You also do your own photographs of country music people. So you have a museum. Basically, you have your own country
and
music
a big insurance and a big insurance bill to go with it. I came to Nashville at a wonderful time in 1972, but there came a time in the late 70s and the early 80s when, as you said, there was those suits and those guitars and those boots and those manuscripts kind of fell out of favor due to the changing of the garden, the changing of times around the world of country music. And I started seeing those artifacts come to sales in thrift shops around town. People were throwing things away. A lot of guitar buyers in Japan were buying our instruments. So I just kind of took it as a family matter, like throwing away the family jewels. And so when I started making more than $2 in a row, I just kind of went on a mission, the crusade, to save our culture. The Country Music Hall of Fame was doing a wonderful job of it. But as a private collector, That's what I went for, and I feel good about it. And started in my bedroom, and I think it's the largest private collection of country music artifacts in the world now, about 20,000 artifacts strong. But it was a job worthy of its attention, because it touched my heart.
And another thing that happened in your life, and very few people can say this, you married the person who was one of your idols when you were young.
Connie Smith.
Yeah, the country music singer Connie Smith. And you went to see her when you were, what, 12?
My mom took my sister Jennifer and me to see Connie Smith when she came to our town of Philadelphia. And there's the Choctaw Indian Reservation, the Mississippi Band of Choctaws. They have a great fair that still goes on down there every year. But Connie Smith was the star. She was a RCA Victor recording sensation. And she came to our town and sang her songs in July of 1970. And she looked so pretty to me. I thought she was an angel. And I got my picture made with her that night and got her autograph. And on the way home, I told my mom, I said, I'm going to marry Connie Smith someday. So it took me 25 years to talk her into it, but we're happily married for almost 20 years now.
Yeah, that's great. And you've produced music by her. She performs on your TV show a lot. And you duet with her on your previous album, which is called Ghost Train. And there's a song of yours that you sing called I Run to You. Did you write this for her?
Connie and I wrote it together.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
We've written several songs together, and we were writing songs and this song came out of the sky, and I said, Connie, this is a good song. And I'm very, very cautious about singing with her. She's kind of like Frank Sinatra or Barbra Streisand. She's that level of singer. She does not need a bit of help. And usually when I hear people sing with Connie, it just distracts me. But I knew this was a good song, and it spoke from our hearts, and it told our story. And so it was an honest performance. And we recorded it back at RCA Studio B, where she recorded all of her hits back in, you know, from the beginning of her career on. And so the sound of her voice coming back up in that room was just absolutely magical.
Marty Stewart, thank you so much for talking with us and for performing for us. It's just been a treat. Thank you.
And it has been a treat to be on your show. Thank you, Terry.
This is my guest, Marty Stewart, with his wife, Connie Smith, from Marty Stewart's album Ghost Train. And this is I Run to You.
Run to you when I'm lonely. I run to you when I'm feeling blue. Each step I take leads to you. Sometimes cold and hard to bear. What would I do, sweetheart, if you weren't there? When things go wrong and my dreams fall apart, you lift me up. Touch my heart, I run to you.
I Run to You is from Marty Stewart's 2010 album, Ghost Train. Stewart's new album is called Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. Coming up, we'll listen to Terry's interview with mortician Caitlin Doty, author of the new memoir, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and other lessons from the crematory. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recorded with licensed mortician Caitlin Doty. Doty is trying to reform how we handle the deaths of loved ones and prepare for our own. She's the founder of the Order of the Good Death, a group of funeral industry professionals, academics, and artists that focuses on rituals we perform with our dead and how we dispose of dead bodies. Dodie also has her own web series called Ask a Mortician, in which she answers questions on a wide range of subjects, including home death, pet death, necrophilia, and what happens to breast implants and titanium hip replacements after a body is cremated. Dodie started her career working as a crematory operator for a family-owned mortuary. She soon will be starting her own funeral service in Los Angeles. Dodie has a new memoir called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory.
Caitlin Dodie, welcome to Fresh Air. So before we talk about death and working at a mortuary, I want to talk about how we're going to talk about death. So,
okay,
you've been exposed to, you know, some beautiful and some gruesome things in your work. You've handled a lot of corpses, some in better shape than others. I know some people who are listening will be upset if we talk graphically. What is your philosophy about how to speak about the physical remains of the dead and what is done to them in the process before burial or cremation, without seeming disrespectful of the dead and the dead's living loved ones?
My philosophy is honesty. I think that we've been so hidden from death in this culture for such a long time that it's very refreshing and liberating to talk about death in an open, honest manner. And I don't use vivid details to try and get a rise out of anyone. That's not the intention. But I don't think that there's anything wrong with open discussion, because frankly, there's a lot of facts in quotation marks now in our society and in the way we discuss things. And so removing the quotation marks and having it being facts in the tangible, in the concrete, even if it's about something kind of disgusting and kind of visceral and kind of threatening like death, I still believe it's the best policy.
So your first job in the death business, if I may call it that, was in a mortuary, actually cremating the corpses. What was your image of cremation before you actually worked in a crematory?
I think it was probably more romantic than it actually ended up being. I thought of the idea of, I mean, I knew they were machines, but I still had this connotation of the open-air pyre and leading the body to it and placing it on the pyre and everybody's weeping and it's beautiful. But the reality that I found is that modern crematories are really industrial environments, and the body goes into large industrial machines, and oftentimes I was the only one there, and it's hot and it's dirty and you get covered in dust as you're working, and it was
by
much
dust you
less...
mean the ashes of the corpse.
I mean the ashes of the corpse, yes, jumping right into the honest talk. It's the ashes of the corpse, which are actually inorganic bone fragments, which means that they are the organic material that is the body, which is your organs, your flesh, the clothes that you're wearing, all burn up. And what's left is inorganic bone. And that's what we actually know of as ashes. And there's so much of it that it can, when you're taking it out of the machine, get on you and get into strange little places that you didn't even know you had to get dust on your body.
So it wasn't the romantic image that you have of the body being transformed into ash.
No, it wasn't pure. I mean, the idea is that the body is purified by fire, and that is true, but the actual working environment was not very romantic, no.
So one of the things you do is recommend better practices, you know, what you'd consider better practices and more organic practices when it comes to the process surrounding, you know, dealing with the corpse and, you know, burying or cremating. So when it comes to cremation, what would you like to see changed?
If I could see anything change, it would be the level of involvement of the family in the death rituals. Because when I was working at the crematory, the most shocking thing to me wasn't so much the decomposing bodies or the strange bodies that I saw. It really was that I was alone there, and I was sending all of these people off to their final, you know, disposition in the crematory machine, and there was no one there, and it didn't feel right because I didn't know these people. And it was an honor, and I took it very seriously. But the times when families did come, and that's called a witness cremation, which is something you can ask for at your local crematory or your funeral home. When there was a witness cremation and the family was there and they sat with the body and they took the time and they pushed the button to send the body into the flames, it was an incredibly powerful experience because they took responsibility for that body and they took responsibility for that death and for that loss to the community. And that to me is the thing that we've lost, and it's most crucial that we get back.
You know, I didn't even know that that was an option.
A lot of people don't. And it's not, when I say that, it's not intended to be blamey, like, oh, you abandoned this body. Because when I talk to people about this, a shocking number don't realize that they have all the power in the world with the dead body. The corpse is actually considered quasi-property, which means the family or the person who is in charge of the dead body, the closest next of kin, essentially owns that dead body. It doesn't have to go immediately to a funeral home. It doesn't have to go out of their hands. They have an incredible amount of power to take the time and decide what they want to do with that dead body.
So just one more thing about the idea of the witness cremation. Mm-hmm. I would guess that most crematories are not really designed to have the family and friends gathering around the oven. And it might be such a kind of unpleasant environment for an emotional send-off like that, since it's not designed for that.
Some crematories are better than others. I think it's good for us to be moving towards crematories that are absolutely designed for that, that have big, beautiful skylights and ability to play music. You know, who wouldn't want to be sent off with chanting in the background, or Wagner playing, or something that meant a lot to the deceased person, and candles and flowers and all of these things that, yes, the crematory machine is a big industrial machine, but ways to not cover it up, but to make the family just generally comfortable in the environment while still feeling like they're very present for this somewhat difficult but necessary thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Caitlin Doty, and she's a licensed mortician who's written a new book, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. And she is also very interested in the history of how different cultures and religions over the centuries have dealt with corpses. So she's very deeply immersed in all things death. We were just talking about cremation. I want to talk with you about the obvious alternative, which is burial. What direct work have you done with practices related to burial?
Since I live in Southern California and was in Northern California before, California is primarily and increasingly a cremation state. So I've done more cremation than anything else. But I did go to school to be an embalmer in something called mortuary school, which is a real thing. And you learn to be an embalmer. And embalming is the practice that the American funeral industry was essentially built on. And it's preservation, short-term preservation of the body for a viewing. And then the body goes in the casket, and the idea would be that you were buried after you are embalmed. But my personal opinion is that we should be moving towards not embalming unless it's absolutely necessary, because it is a chemical process, and it can be an expensive process for the family. And return more to just the body as it naturally is, and letting it be buried without a big vault and without a big casket and without embalming, just straight into the ground in a shroud or decomposable casket, and be allowed to go back into the earth.
So there's a movement now to just put the body straight in the ground and to bypass the coffin and certainly the embalming.
Yeah, there absolutely is. There's a movement not only to do that, but to also take care of the body yourself in the home. So in a way, bypassing the funeral director and the mortuary entirely.
And you're an advocate of that.
I am. I am a mortician who tells you that you don't necessarily need a mortician.
So it on the one hand sounds kind of simple, like take care of the corpse at home. But one, I don't know what that entails. And two, it does sound almost like a frightening responsibility, because how many of us have actually handled corpses and prepared them for burial? I mean, what are you taking on if you take that on?
It might be a frightening responsibility, but it's also a really incredible responsibility, because first of all, we've been led to believe that dead bodies are dangerous in some way, which they're, for the most part, they're absolutely not. Especially a body that would die at home is going to be a very safe corpse. Bacteria that cause decomposition are not the bacteria that cause disease. You're not going to catch a disease from a dead body that you're taking care of. And there are two reasons that I think taking care of a dead body yourself are so powerful. The first reason is that this is somebody that you loved, and over a period of a day or 2 days or however long you keep them in your home, you get to see them change in little subtle ways. You can see almost the life leave them. You can feel the body growing colder. You can see that this person that was a part of your community and a part of your life is not going to be there anymore. And you can take the time to address any feelings that that might bring up. And then the second thing is that if you don't really see any dead bodies, it's hard to know for sure that you're going to die. And when you have the opportunity to be there with a dead body and really look it in the face and stare your own mortality in the face, it's a real clear message that you too are going to die. And that message is missing from a lot of our culture right now. And I would argue that this is one of the best ways to get that back.
You went to mortuary school and studied embalming. And you left that program not wanting to embalm. What happened at the school that changed your mind about embalming?
Well, I think I did know before I went to school that I didn't necessarily agree with it. And I think things that happened at school just confirmed that for me. It's a very invasive process, and a lot of people don't realize that. It involves removing the blood from the circulatory system through a vein and then putting chemicals, including formaldehyde, to replace the blood. And then it also involves penetrating the internal organs and putting chemicals there as well. And for me, it doesn't seem necessary. If you're shipping a body to Germany or something, you probably want to embalm it. Or if there's some reason that you need to preserve it for a long period of time at the coroner's or medical examiner's office, or for a medical school study, perhaps. But other than that, if you're just going to have it at a wake and then bury it, it doesn't really make sense to have this environmentally unfriendly, invasive procedure done.
You actually recently left the mortuary where you were working to start your own business. What's your ambition with the business that you're starting?
The ambition is to, it's called Undertaking LA, and the ambition is to educate people on what we've been talking about, on their power and ability to take care of a lot of the things around death themselves and within their own family, and using the funeral industry as a tool for the parts that they maybe don't want to do or are perhaps not comfortable with, but knowing that all the things that they are legally and physically and emotionally and mentally capable of doing themselves.
So, you know, you have a very popular website and blog. The website's called The Order of the Good Death, and your web series on there is called Ask a Mortician, which you have videos asking, you know, answering questions that you've been asked. And you're really into, you know, just like looking at death as a reality and just kind of accepting that this is what death is, as opposed to like trying to hide from it or protect yourself from it. At the same time, we now have the option, the grotesque option of seeing hideous, ugly, vicious death. And I'm thinking specifically of the beheading videos that ISIS has released. And you know, people have had the option of watching that if they've wanted to. They've been warned by all kinds of people not to watch. But I wonder, as somebody who's, you know, trying to get people to, you know, examine what death really is, what goes through your mind when you hear about this grotesque theater and of the desecration of life and death that those videos signify?
Yeah. I'm very comfortable with seeing dead bodies, and I'm very comfortable with death, but there is no way in the world that I would choose to watch one of those videos. And because there's a huge difference between violence and the psychological terror that they're trying to create with a video like that, and a dead body in its natural state. Death in its natural state can be very beautiful. When you think about a body that's died of natural causes, family taking care of it, all of that is very beautiful. But that, in a way, almost has nothing to do with death being used as psychological terror. And one of the ways that they have been able to, anywhere in the world where people are using terror or using means, psychological means, they're taking death. And because we're so uncomfortable with death as it naturally is, hijacking death for that purpose is going to be that much more powerful, and it's going to be that much more difficult to see, and that much more damaging to our psyche and to our morale. And I think that anybody doing that knows that. And is, as a culture, if we were more comfortable with death as it naturally is, there wouldn't be this kind of perverse theater element to videos like that.
Caitlin Doty is the author of the new book, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and Other Lessons from the Crematory. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.